The Patient's Eyes by David Pirrie. Copyright 2001 by David Pirrie. This full-length reading was published by arrangement with Carlyle and Company and was produced in 2001 by Books on Tape Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. This book has 252 pages and is read by Richard Matthews. Should you have any questions about this recording, please call the customer service number shown on the package for information or assistance. This book bears a dedication for Joyce Pirrie. Author's note. The most remarkable experiences in a man's life, and which he feels most, are precisely the ones upon which he is least disposed to talk. Arthur Conan Doyle. This story makes no pretense to be based on some manuscript found in a tin trunk in Paulson's Bank in the Strand, or retrieved from the attic of a legal consultancy in Baker Street, nor is it attributable to John Watson, M.D., but it can claim to be based in part on historical fact. The arguments about Arthur Conan Doyle's early life continue to rage, but two things are certain. Doyle's model for Sherlock Holmes, Joseph Bell, did investigate criminal cases. And Doyle suppressed so many facts and incidents of his personal history that his true relationship with the doctor remains shrouded in mystery. Indeed, with Doyle's papers and letters still locked away from the world, the creator of Holmes remains, for all his great fame, among the most mysterious of Victorians. More facts, however, are emerging every day, some of them startling. This story draws on them as well, of course, as Doyle's own writing, and in one respect at least, the dark beginnings of Sherlock Holmes' cycle can indeed claim to be inspired by a mysterious manuscript. If it ever saw the light of day, Joseph Bell's Criminal Cases by Arthur Doyle, a book rumoured to have been seen early in this century, would certainly mark the uncovering of one of the world's greatest mysteries. For we would finally have laid our hands on something once thought to be utterly impossible. The true stories of Sherlock Holmes. 7:13 p.m. The 12th of October, 1898. And so finally I come to them. This moment, this bright autumn of 1898, when I have decided for better or worse that I will have to try to translate the cases with the doctor into words. They were always my secrets, 16 in all, though I had knowledge of two others. And I can be sure only of one thing. If you are reading these words, I am dead. Occasionally, of course, there were hints of them in my fiction, some detail which had imprinted itself upon my memory, a weapon, an article of clothing, the furnishings of a room, a particularly strange object, would find its way into a story. The copper beeches in particular flirted with events that had actually happened. Fortunately for me, the doctor did not see it until many years later. Naturally, he did not care for it at all, or any of these other hints. He would reproach me with one of the looks I knew so well, that withering straight-arrow glance that felt as if it could pierce a man's soul. You knew the terms, it seemed to say. Absolute confidentiality. Not that there was any real need for his concern. How could there be, when the cases themselves contained so much that was acutely painful to me? Matters of such darkness and depravity could never be considered material for fiction, let alone a history. Especially when any such history would inevitably take me back through the years to that awful afternoon on a beach near Dunbar, where we found Elsbeth. Here was, I suppose, the true beginning of our story, when the doctor stood by the waves and declared his fight against the future. The words may sound foolish unless you know all that prompted them. For me, then, as we both recognized how profoundly we had failed and all that must lie ahead in our own branch of interest, it was the very least he could have said. I was a young man then, only 19 and in the second year of my medical degree at Edinburgh, where I had met the doctor about 6 months previously. It is true there were problems in my family, but even so I had everything to live for, until that moment on the beach, all those years ago, seemed for a time to bring my life to an end. Until now, that was the worst moment. so unbearable that I have usually tried to avoid thinking of it. But in general nobody could have such experiences as I had with a doctor in my younger years, and not return to them. They would come to me while I was sailing on the Arctic whaler Hope, the first expedition I ever took, or when I stood alone in the evening air outside the Tennyson Road house in South Norwood, which I bought years later after I abandoned medicine for good. I would reflect on each extraordinary episode with Bell, considering what it told me about my fellow humanity and about the darkness within my own sex. No full accounts were ever compiled of our cases, but the truth was I had not been entirely true to my pledge. For each of them I still held boxes containing records of a kind, a map worked and reworked, diagrams, objects, odd hieroglyphs and puzzles and clues which reflected for me and no one else the intimate details of each adventure. I came to think of these materials as my murder rooms. Although one box, containing all that led up to that beach and followed on from it, has remained at the back, unopened. Naturally, I never attempted to explain these relics from years ago to anyone, not even Louise, my wife, when she was still in good health, though she often saw me studying some of the boxes and adding small details. The assumption, of course, was that I was planning a story, an assumption that now, in a way I never dreamed, almost comes true. But before I write, I must be clear about what has happened this autumn and why I am taking this step now. I will not pretend it has been a happy year, for despite my success there has been much inner turbulence in my life. But when, 2 weeks ago, I took Louise for a drive in the Landau, up on the heathland north of Hindhead, I had no idea of what was coming. Both of us share a love of this lonely and somewhat uncharacteristic stretch of wild country running above the home we built in the hope the air would improve her health. Since first setting eyes on it, the countryside here has reminded me of my native Scotland with its glens and valleys. But that day we did not travel far, for, as we came on to the spur that is known locally as White Hill owing to its frosts, Louise began coughing. It went on a few minutes only, and, though she insisted we go on, I could see how glad she was when we turned for home. There I sat beside her bed for half an hour, and was relieved at last to watch her sleep. I waited a little, before coming down to my study, a room with broad windows offering a view of the woods behind the house. I sat down at my desk, and then I noticed the small brown paper package. It had been placed at the corner of my desk, as late deliveries often are. I received a great deal of post, but there was something different about this parcel. Perhaps because it was done up very elaborately with yards of knotted string. It bore my typewritten address, and the postmark was Bristol, a city I barely know. After observing these details, I ignored it for an hour while I worked. But I think even then it gave me a tiny sense of unease. There was something so painstaking and excessive about those intricate lengths of string winding around it. As I worked, I found myself reflecting that it was too thin to be a book, yet too broad and wide to be a personal item like my watch, which was soon due back from its annual clean. Eventually, while I was drinking my late morning tea, I took up the package. Cutting the string, I pulled the layers of brown paper back. All I could see were several pages torn from a periodical. I picked them up and stared at a familiar illustration of a woman removing her veil. This was an early Holmes story of mine, published in the Strand magazine in the winter of 1892. Naturally, I supposed it had been sent for my autograph, though it was the first time I had ever been asked to sign loose pages. I leafed through them, and soon reached the last illustration, which shows the detective holding a candle aloft in front of the stricken villain. I could find no accompanying letter at all. There was nothing else here. Absolutely no indication of who had sent this, or why. My first assumption was that there must be something in the pages themselves which might explain the parcel. A typographic flaw, perhaps, or some other oddity that a reader had thought I would be interested to see myself. And so it was that I put my work aside and scanned the Holmes Adventure, the speckled band, for the first time in years.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?